drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza Pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Condemning U.S. military action in Afghanistan as an abject and deadly failure, the Congressional Progressive Caucus pressed the Biden administration to engage in diplomacy with the emerging Taliban government. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, reporter. This article is published under the heading 20 years of war have failed. Progressive Caucus urges U.S. diplomacy with Taliban. Stay tuned for more. Condemning U.S. military action in Afghanistan as an abject and deadly failure, the Congressional Progressive Caucus recently pressed the Biden administration to engage in diplomacy with the emerging Taliban government and provide as much as humanitarian aid as possible to the countless civilians devastated by the past 2 decades of war by American troops. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the CPC, reiterated her caucus support for the ongoing withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan.
As the administration faces criticism from Republicans and members of his own party over how the exit has unfolded, we continue to maintain, as the White House clearly does, that even after spending $1 trillion, sending hundreds of thousands of troops into Afghanistan over 20 years, and losing 2,300 American lives, the United States could not have averted this outcome without an endless military presence. Jayapal said in a statement referring to the former U.S.-backed Afghan regime's rapid fall to Taliban, which took control of the capital of Kabul over the weekend and is currently in talks to form a new government. Despite this consensus, congressional Republicans have disingenuously chosen to play politics at this moment, the Washington Democrats said. Republican administrations began the war in Afghanistan, controlled it for 12 of the past 20 years, and initiated a peace process with the Taliban last year that led to an agreement for a U.S. withdrawal. They should participate in the needed examination of why 20 years of war have failed, rather than playing the blame game. Our focus now must be on the human beings on receiving end of this policy. With millions of Afghans internally displaced and in need of humanitarian aid, and as thousands, including many women and children, attempt to flee the country, the CPC is calling on the Biden administration to go further and work faster in effort to provide assistance to desperate civilians. Jayapal said the United States must ensure refugee processing moves forward without bureaucratic delay and with special allowances recognizing the difficulty for people to leave Afghanistan. In addition to the State Department's work to expedite special immigrant visas, we must also expand these visas and grant temporary protected status to Afghans residing in the U.S. We must increase humanitarian aid to support civilians who fled to Kabul and provincial capitals and are without shelter, food, medical assistance, or vaccines. The United States shuttered its embassy in Kabul as the Taliban closed in on Afghan capital over the weekend, and the administration is currently in the process of evacuating American diplomats from the country as it moves to end the disastrous, but for some immensely profitable, 20-year occupation. While U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said during a briefing recently that the Biden administration intends to pursue diplomacy and a political settlement in Afghanistan. Despite the withdrawal of embassy staff, he warned that the U.S. in partnership with the international community could impose significant costs on the Taliban government if it does not respect the basic rights of its people, a reference to possible economic sanctions. As the Washington Post reported recently, the Biden administration has frozen Afghan government reserves held in U.S. accounts, blocking the Taliban from accessing billions of dollars held in U.S. institutions. The recent moves prompted concern that the administration may be planning additional economic measures that could hinder the flow of badly needed humanitarian aid in Afghanistan, where an estimated 18 million people are in dire need of assistance. Adam Smith, who served on the National Security Council during the Obama administration, told the Post that it could be cataclysmic for Afghanistan if the administration does not handle the sanctions issue deftly. This is a potentially serious humanitarian issue that I am hoping people in our government are thinking long and hard about, Smith said. In a statement earlier Representative Ilhan Omar, the CPC whip and Somali refugee, said that the U.S. has an obligation to help redress the humanitarian crises stemming from the fundamental failures of American policy in Afghanistan over the course of many decades and four presidencies. Of course, the tragedy did not begin in the last couple of weeks. The hard truth about America's longest war is that for 20 years, we made promises we couldn't keep, said Omar, adding, the simple fact is that prolonging a war indefinitely would not have delivered a stable, peaceful Afghanistan. An endless American military occupation of Afghanistan was unacceptable. Referring to failures of the U.S. in Afghanistan, Omar said, war and conflict never produce peace and stability. Violence and militarism, even when cloaked in the language of humanitarianism, are fundamentally at odds with human flourishing and opportunity. Violence only produces trauma that can turn into anger, vengefulness, and a continuing cycle of violence. That must be a lesson as we deal with conflicts around the world. The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the fall of Kabul and the reasons behind the rapid destruction of the governing power despite decades of U.S. training and support for the Afghan military. And we shall take a look at the possible scenarios that may unfold in Afghanistan under the new era of Taliban's rule.
The invasion and occupation of Afghanistan was filled with failure after failure since the beginning. But under the fourth U.S. president, it became a global disaster. The United States says they had been training and strengthening the country's military and administration during the last decade or so. But it took about only a fortnight for Taliban to regain control of Afghanistan.
Thanks to our military and our allies, and the brave fighters of Afghanistan, the Taliban regime is coming to an end.
The 2001 invasion of Afghanistan was sold to the world as a necessary war to control Al-Qaeda by removing the Taliban from power. Now, almost 20 years later, the Taliban has effectively seized control of the country while the American-led occupiers are rushing to escape. Capital city Kabul was the last major territory to fall with the collapse of the country's government as President Ashraf Ghani fled abroad. The George W. Bush administration started the war following 9/11 attacks. The early Barack Obama years were marked by an increased military presence, which purportedly led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. Donald Trump initially escalated engagement, but eventually withdrew some forces and helped initiate talks between Taliban and Afghan governments. Joe Biden came into office with a commitment to ending the U.S. war in Afghanistan on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. His latest move is the redeployment of 5,000 troops to help evacuate embassy personnel. In his address to American people, Biden said the U.S. mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to have been nation-building. It was never supposed to be creating a unified, centralized democracy. The United States apparently were heading the opposite direction.
Although many regions were scenes of bloodshed and bitter instances of violence, there were many parts across the country that witnessed a smooth and bloodless transition of power to the insurgents.
The surge of Taliban was so fast that many personnel from different embassies and consulates are not yet out of the country, and the chaos in airports is increasingly costly. The haphazard evacuation process may be a sign of terrible miscalculations by the Western intelligence agencies. They had thought they had more time. When the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in the 1980s, the governing structure they had put in place lasted for years. The regime that the United States had created was thrashed in a matter of days, and they probably knew this would happen. Trying to make their catastrophic failure less noticeable, a great deal of Americans' efforts during the talks in Doha was aimed at coaxing Taliban towards sharing some of the power with the government of Ashraf Ghani. But at this point, Washington has no leverage, and the central government has no bargaining chip because Taliban is making impressive advances in the battlefield.
Almost the entire Afghanistan is now under Taliban's rule, just like 20 years ago when the U.S. invaded the country. But many people, including Taliban itself, say this new era is different. The Taliban political leadership said in Doha that they are not the same group that ruled Afghanistan in the 90s, but a lot of people are not persuaded, because even the group's political leaders don't seem to have total control over the actions of their grassroots supporters.
The summer push by Taliban and its consequent flash takeover of the country by the militant group did not come as a surprise. Almost everybody expected it to happen. The shock was its speed and its similarities to a well-planned transition of power. Some cities were seized after hours of gunfights for each street or neighborhood, but in some parts of the country, the only shots heard were bullets fired into the air by Taliban militants as they celebrated their victory into the cities.
After they secured authority over the country, Taliban released a video and congratulated people on their new leadership. And quite unlikely of what they are known for, Taliban militants said it's now time for serenity in the country. For now, the question of the people of Afghanistan is whether the return of the Taliban will also mark a return to the Taliban's old ways, or whether the new era represents some fundamental transformation.
Clashes and casualties were reported in some regions, like the heavily defended northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, the country's fourth largest city, which government forces and two influential former strongmen had pledged to defend. But Taliban achieved most of its gains not by fighting, but by persuading the officials and troops to surrender en masse. The city of Jalalabad, for instance, was conquered without any fight because the tribal elders had already negotiated a peaceful surrender before Taliban marched into the key eastern city, which is also the capital of Nangarhar province.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Elijah McNair, veteran war correspondent and senior political risk analyst. Before we begin, I would like to welcome Mr. McNair to the program. Mr. McNair, what do you think are the main reasons for the fall of Kabul?
The main reason for the fall of Kabul is the U.S. occupation of the country relies on a corrupted government, and they made no real contact with the population to be accepted because obviously they are an occupation force. Therefore, the population had enough of this corrupted government. One province after another was falling in the hands of Taliban because they just wanted the Americans to leave. And the Americans showed that they have no control over 300,000 of the Afghani army. They spent 20 years in the country training them and equipping them. And the army collapsed, and the president, his vice, and all the Afghani officials fled the country in the first hours.
Mr. Magnaya, who or what could have prevented such eventuality?
Nothing could have prevented such eventuality because the occupier will end up leaving the country. No occupation force can stay in a country. They can stay for 1 year, for 10, for 20. At the end of the day, they have to leave because they are indeed an occupation force. So sooner or later, the Americans, had they choose to remain in the country, they would have left after 1 month or 1 year or a couple of years because they were losing the war. So nothing would prevent the return of Kabul to the Afghani people and the departure of the NATO forces.
Thank you. Now let's put a hold on the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the collapse of the Western-backed government of Kabul by Taliban.
CFR writes, even before Biden released the plan for a full withdrawal by September 11, 2021, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg had warned that a poor handling of withdrawing troops could allow Afghanistan to become a haven for Takfiri terrorists as Daesh or ISIL moves to rebuild its so-called caliphate. Press TV says, Republican Senator Ben Sasse has said, the retreat from Afghanistan is our worst foreign policy disaster in a generation, adding that the Biden administration failed to even protect the American embassy in Afghanistan. This bloodshed wasn't just predictable, it was predicted. For months, Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee have warned the Biden administration that this would happen. Now the administration is acting like this is a surprise. It's shameful, dishonest spin, he said. FT writes, pictures of helicopters lifting off from the U.S. Embassy recall the humiliating fall of Saigon in 1975, something President Joe Biden dismissed just last month as implausible. This is a tragedy for the people of the country and a betrayal of the thousands of U.S. and allied troops and more than 120,000 Afghans who died in 20 years of war. It is a grave setback, too, for the credibility of the U.S. and of the community of democracies Biden hoped to cement. And a few words from CNBC. While the end result and bloodletting once we left was never in doubt, the speed of collapse is unreal. One former intelligence official and U.S. Marine who served in Afghanistan has said, requesting anonymity due to professional restrictions.
Welcome back, everyone. Mr. Magnaya, what can the Afghan government do now? Are we going to see a violent transition of power or a kind of power-sharing agreement?
The only choice for the Taliban forces today is to form a coalition where all the main ethnic groups participate in this government. Otherwise, they will fail and there will be, again, instability in Afghanistan. That is the only choice the Taliban has in front of them. And I think they've started the negotiation in Qatar, and what they need to include the Tajik and the Uzbek and the Pashtun in one government.
So what can we expect? What is the role or fate of the ordinary Afghan people in the next administration?
I think the Taliban said that they're going to pardon everybody, and they issued 3 pardons in 1 week. It means they want to protect the infrastructure, they want the police to return to work, and they want the normal employee to continue functioning, otherwise the whole state will collapse. These employee are not part with or against the occupation forces or with the American or with the Taliban. They are workers and they are employees, and they are essential to the well-functioning of the state. And the police announced already that they have nothing to do with what's happening and with the politics, and they do their job as usual, and this is a good step.
Mr. McNair, the United States and NATO said they have been training the Afghan army for many years. How come the Taliban managed to take over Kabul this fast?
The U.S. forces trained the Afghan 300,000 member of the army for 20 years, and this army refused to fight and collapsed in 1 week. Well, we've seen that in Mosul in Iraq, when they've trained the Iraqi army for 11 years, and it has collapsed in 3 days. This is, the training offers nothing. It doesn't offer the ideology and the motivation to defend one country. How they can train an army when this army is under the occupation command, and they ask loyalty to an occupation force rather than the loyalty to the country they live in? This is why it's normal for Afghani army to collapse, particularly when the U.S. pro-U.S. president Ashraf Ghani left and abandoned the country and escaped.
So what do you think the regional countries or the international community should do?
I think the regional countries, and here we're talking about Pakistan, Iran, Russia and China, are different from the international community. The international community wants to try to create a model like the international community and the Western culture in Afghanistan, and they failed. However, the regional country don't want to impose their culture on Afghanistan and would like to work with a good government in Afghanistan that is working to establish good relationship with the regional country. What the regional countries are asking for from Afghanistan is stability, security, to make sure that the jihadists are not crossing from Afghanistan into Iran or into China or into Russia, and they want a good relationship. While the international community is asking from Afghanistan to implement the Western values, which is not possible. So they have to find a way in between to make sure that the sovereignty of Afghanistan is not violated and that Afghanistan is not in a bad term with everybody like Taliban used to be in the 1990s.
Just one last question, sir. How do you predict the future weeks for Afghanistan, and will the American troops come back?
I don't think the Americans will come back ever to West Asia, because they have learned their lesson, and they know today that first, they are not welcome. Second, that waging war on countries in the Middle East, like they've done in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and they tried in Iran, resulted in the total failure of the U.S. forces, and now they are pulling out, and I hope that they will leave soon Iraq. Therefore, I think the Americans will never return with forces. However, that is not stopping them from using sanctions to starve the population. That is a new war that the Americans are doing, and their partners, the Europeans, are following. And that is more dangerous than the military war.
Thank you, Mr. McNair, for your precious time and knowledge. Love to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation in Afghanistan.
Pakistani lawmaker Mohsen Dawar slams U.S. President Joe Biden for betraying Afghans and using their country for proxy wars. Says Biden has blood on his hands. Sana Safi, Afghan-British journalist, calls out Biden's duplicity, says he never mentioned thousands of Afghans killed in the U.S.-imposed war, including her cousin killed by American forces 2 years ago. British parliamentarian Zahra Sultana cites horrific scenes in Afghanistan past few weeks to condemn what she calls catastrophic wars started by George Bush and Tony Blair, former leaders of US and UK. Prominent Indian filmmaker Shekhar Kapoor says Western colonial powers have always colonized nations, destroyed them and walked away, from Africa to Middle East to Afghanistan. Ismail Mikhail, the head of Afghanistan's state broadcaster, lambasts US President Joe Biden for what he calls irresponsible withdrawal from the war-ravaged country, says history will remember him for it.
And that was our special episode on the collapse of Afghanistan's governing power and the factors that accelerated the fall of Kabul. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Former President Donald Trump has claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban just days after the Taliban took control of Kabul and effectively gained control of Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist James Crump, writing for the Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled Donald Trump Tells Hannity America Being Set Up by Taliban. Former President Donald Trump has claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban, just days after the Taliban took control of Kabul and effectively gained control of Afghanistan. Trump made the comments during a Tuesday night, 17th of August, interview with Fox News Channel host Sean Hannity, where he was asked about the ongoing situation in Afghanistan that has seen hundreds of Afghans trying to flee the country by climbing onto military planes after the Taliban took control of Kabul. Sean Hannity asked Donald Trump about his dealings with Taliban leaders and the Afghan government, as he had prepared to withdraw U.S. military troops from the region during his time in charge. The troops were officially ordered out of the area by President Joe Biden in April, and the Taliban took control of the country just a few weeks before they were scheduled to leave on 11th of September. Donald Trump claimed that the United States is being set up by the Taliban, telling Sean Hannity, "I never saw anything so stupid in my life until the last few days with Afghanistan. That blows the stupidity of the southern border away." He added, "What's happening in Afghanistan is unbelievable, and we are being set up by the very tough people that are very great negotiators. I'll tell you what, they're automatically great negotiators who have been fighting for 1,000 years, and everything about them, they negotiate. We are being set up, and in a certain way, I guarantee you, they consider them to be hostages, and let's see what happens over the coming weeks." Donald Trump also claimed there could be as many as 40,000 potential hostages left behind in Afghanistan. Trump, who had promised to bring U.S. troops home from Afghanistan, reached an agreement with the Taliban when he was in office that set a 1st of May 2021 deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. forces with conditions. The former president said he told the top Taliban leader that if any Americans were harmed, we will hit you with a force that no country has ever been hit with before. Despite Donald Trump's claims that the Taliban had been fighting for thousands of years, in actual fact, the Taliban was only founded back in 1994, holding power in a majority of Afghanistan between 1996 and 2001, before U.S. forces invaded the country. Later in the interview with Sean Hannity of Fox News Channel on Tuesday, 17th of August, Donald Trump claimed that he had a conditions-based agreement with the Taliban after they agreed a ceasefire with him, where if any Americans or allies were harmed, then the U.S. would retaliate by bombing parts of the country. He said that Joe Biden should have got all of the U.S. civilians out of Afghanistan first, before saying the president's actions have caused the greatest embarrassment in the history of our country. And adding, it's a great thing that we're getting out of Afghanistan, but nobody has ever handled the withdrawal worse than Joe Biden. President Biden made his first remarks in Afghanistan for a week at the White House on Monday, 16th of August, where he dismissed criticisms of his decision to withdraw U.S. forces from the region, saying, if anything, the development of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. Joe Biden also noted that he inherited a deal from Donald Trump to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, before once again backing the decision, saying, American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves. Former President Donald Trump also criticized his successor's handling of the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, saying he would have gotten Americans and equipment out of the country before military personnel, and that he had an agreement with the Taliban he was willing to back up with force.
Economic divide.
Protests in Cuba saw angry Cubans come out to the streets. This tiny island nation is suffering from a COVID pandemic, which has paralyzed the economy of the country. But what's more paralyzing and detrimental are the cruel U.S. sanctions in place for decades. Hi, I'm Kavit Afwai, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how these sanctions are not excuses by the Cuban government in its economic shortcomings. Coming up in this program, Cuban protests, the largest in decades due to economic hardships. The tiny island nation has been suffering from U.S. sanctions for decades now. Then we will take a look at what these U.S. sanctions are actually all about. They are comprehensive, they are indiscriminate, and they are quite devastating, from sanctions on oil to currency, which has the most negative impact on the population of the island. Now, the world wants Cuban sanctions lifted. All UN countries except for the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Does the U.S. want regime change in that country?
Recent protests in Cuba. Cubans, angry over long lines of food, power outages, and medicine shortages. Like many countries, racked by the COVID-19 pandemic, these were most widespread since Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution. But was this spontaneous, or were there foreign hands at play? The Facebook group City of Humor is said to be responsible for the protests.
Espontáneo nada. Desde hace tiempo hizo suya esa tarea un grupo de Facebook nombrado La Villa del Humor, refiriéndose a San Antonio de los Baños.
Within hours, President Miguel Díaz-Canel came out and said the streets belong to revolutionaries. As if the U.S. embargo on Cuba was not enough, now the U.S. was throwing its full weight behind the protests.
The Biden-Harris administration stands by the Cuban people and people around the world who demand their human rights and who expect governments to listen to and serve them rather than try to silence them.
As much as the U.S. paints a picture that the Cuban government does not have support amongst Cubans, realities on the ground paint a different picture, as seen here. The cost of the U.S. embargo on Cuba is immense. The Cuban government estimates that it has costed $753.69 billion. That's a lot for a tiny island nation. Consider this. Cuba's average GDP between 1970 and the year 2014 was $31.7 billion.
Well, Cubans went out to protest their poor economic conditions, which was one of the largest demos to have hit that island. But that is not the full story, since the picture that is being painted, well, it wants to show that all Cubans are against the government. That is simply not the case. Thousands of Cubans out on the streets showing support for the Cuban government. They were marking the anniversary of the Male Canaza. That was a 1994 uprising linked to dissidents that saw more than 35,000 flee the U.S. Cuba, in short, is hit by three main factors that has led to its economic deterioration. Note, deterioration, not its downfall. Today, the global pandemic, the decades-old U.S. blockade, and sanctions put in place under former U.S. President Donald Trump during his last days in office are the three contributing factors. Now, the former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed harsh sanctions on Cuba before he left office. It was in the form of reducing cash remittances from abroad. 2 million Cubans live in the U.S. Out of that number, 700,000 send money to their families inside Cuba, making it the second most important source of hard currency. The figure for the amount totaled anywhere between $900 million and $1.5 billion annually. That's quite a lot for an economy that does not generate a lot of money. And to put things into perspective, so important are these remittances that it is the main source of direct income for half of Cuba's population. Not the embargo itself. The Cuban government estimates that it has cost the island about $753.69 billion. The annual report to the UN provides a detailed account of that calculation. Again, a lot for a country whose average GDP is between 1970 and 2014 has been calculated to be at $31.7 billion. Our guest joining us for this segment is Vern Lyon. He is a former CIA officer. He's also the author of the book Eyes on Havana, which is a memoir of an American spy that was betrayed by the CIA. Vern, welcome. Taking a look at the recent protests that happened in Cuba, well, Cuba's economy was the reason, but Cuba's economy is crushed due to main three factors: the global pandemic, the decades-old U.S. blockade, and sanctions that were put in place under former President Donald Trump. Now, you have been in Cuba yourself in the past. How do you see things in terms of the way the Cuban economy works?
Well, I think those three factors contribute a great deal to the current state of the Cuban economy. But, you know, even with the North American embargo and blockade, many years I was in Cuba, I experienced the different Cuban agencies that had foreign devises, British pounds, Spanish pesetas, German marks, U.S. dollars, Canadian dollars. They found ways to buy what they needed through other companies and countries. So the blockade was in effect for some things, but the Cubans always managed to find a way around it.
Now, in terms of the way that the Cuban economy works overall, it's time to actually take a look at some of its economic indicators and the economic profile of the Caribbean island nation as a whole. Time now for our InfoNews section. This is where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Now, these are stories that we're considering for our next program. First up, a shocking report, a moment of truth. Code red for humanity. It's a climate change crisis. It hit the headlines throughout the world. It reminded us how we are failing. Dire warnings about irreversible damage to the climate, so severe that it called the crisis inevitable, unprecedented, and irreversible. Great topic for a program. Now, this topic should hurt the African-American community in the U.S. Racism to have cost black Americans $70 trillion. That's quite a bit, less since the start of slavery. Now, Sean Rochester, author of The Black Tax, has said that black people are hired less frequently, they are paid less, and have less access to wealth-building tools like affordable mortgages. Next up, the topic of U.S. guns has always somewhat been in the news, but this time it's for a different reason. Mexico is actually suing U.S. gun manufacturers over arms trafficking. The lawsuit alleges that the companies knew that they were contributing to illegal arms trafficking, which has been linked to many deaths. Mexico is seeking as much as $10 billion in compensation. And finally, we go to a dollar dump that has occurred. No surprise where it has occurred. Russia's sovereign wealth in this case, the fund, has cut the U.S. dollar reserves to zero. Now, the Russian finance ministry said that the yuan and the euro are seen as an alternative to the dollar. Not only has Russia eliminated the U.S. dollar from its military deals, Russians have opted to dump the U.S. dollar in favor of other currencies like the euro. Okay, we're headed for a quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Now we will take a look at what many are unaware of, and that's how Cuba's economy actually functions. Our focus, more or less, is going to be on poverty. But the way we figured is maybe it's best to look at the ways that Cuba's economy should actually not be looked at, because, the usual factors in a capitalist economics, that's basically how the whole world is operating, those are the things that we don't want to look at here. For example, in Cuba's case, socialism and not capitalist economics is what dictates the way the economy works and the usual hallmarks of a capitalist system. For example, how success and failures is the result of either growth and productivity, whether that is contributing to success or failure in terms of a capitalist system. That doesn't really apply to Cuba. It's good to bring some examples here. For example, GDP per capita or money income per day, again, doesn't apply overall to a socialist system because it's just not applicable. Cuba is a different story. Its social and political priorities are actually very different. Let's take a look now at another couple important factors, hunger and homelessness, very important, obviously. Now, Cuba, due to its socialist system, has eliminated a couple things. Here, child malnutrition and homelessness is actually eliminated pretty much, or close to it being eliminated. That means that, for example, no children sleep on the streets. In fact, homelessness is almost at zero. Now, a look at Cuba's economic needs, salaries, residence, etc. The salary for an average Cuban per month is $900, very low, but still it's something that is allocated by the government. But that does not determine the standard and quality of living for Cubans. Because, for example, in terms of residency, we're taking a look at how 85% own their homes, and also rent cannot exceed 4% of a tenant's income. Now, in terms of food, well, the government itself provides a very basic food basket for every Cuban. That suffices for a family of four. And then finally, if you want to take a look at things like utility bills, a few examples here. Transport, for example, and medicine, they are very low. And one of the reasons behind, for example, medicine costs being kept low is because it's being subsidized by the government. Now, the U.S. President Joe Biden did not help when these protests broke out, since he responded by actually branding Cuba a failed state. And he went ahead and sanctioned the military and the police there.
The United States is taking a concerted action to bolster the cause of the Cuban people. We brought to bear the strength of our diplomacy, rallying nations to speak out and increase pressure on the regime, and we're holding the regime accountable. Last week, we sanctioned the head of the Cuban Armed Forces and the government, a government entity called the Black Berets, for their involvement in suppressing protesters. And today, we are adding sanctions against the Revolutionary National Police, as well as individual sanctions against the chief and deputy of chief. Chief and deputy chief.
Classic Biden way. Well, the Cuban president Miguel Díaz-Canel, who, although blaming the U.S. for the protests, immediately reacted actually with promised reforms. Reforms have been in the works actually and have been applied during the time that Luis Castro, Fidel Castro's brother, ruled the island, even though the U.S. sanctions and then Trump sanctions made things harder. Okay, now what he's referring to there is basically credit which Cuba is prevented from getting because of the U.S. sanctions. No credit anywhere in the world, even institutions designed to help countries like Cuba, namely the IMF. Okay, let's bring in our guest for this section of the Q&A. Gloria Estela Larriva is a Latin American expert. In the year 2016, she was the U.S. presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Peace and Freedom Party. Gloria, welcome. We're taking a look at the socialist economy that Cuba has. Basically, it's a planned economy. I'm sure you're well aware of that. Contrary to capitalism, socialist market economies produce goods based on usage values. Hence, we can see, for example, how Cubans own their own homes based on a socialist system. They have free education, etc. Can you please explain the way that the Cuban economy works?
Since 1993, Cuba has engaged in a number of economic changes to stimulate the economy, to bring in foreign investment in order to survive the disastrous collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And it has been able to, with investment in its nickel mining, in the biotechnology, which makes Cuba a powerhouse in biotechnology in the world, and in tourism, which until the pandemic year of 2020 was a major source of income for the country. I would say that with the new changes, a new announcement of allowing larger businesses from Cubans and even people who are Cuban living abroad, that this is another attempt to try to overcome the enormous crisis caused by the almost complete shutdown of tourism because of the pandemic and the tightening of the U.S. blockade, cutting Cuba off from bank transactions in the world, following every bit of commerce that Cuba tries to engage in, and threatening countries and companies that do business with Cuba.
Gloria Larriva there. Time now to take a look at another aspect of the way the U.S. sanctions are affecting Cuba, and that is the humanitarian embargo, part of the embargo that the U.S. claims does not apply when it comes to humanitarian needs for the island.
U.S. sanctions on Cuba are similar to other countries that the U.S. sees as its adversaries, like Iran and Venezuela. The U.S. sanctions are so suffocating that even humanitarian aid is threatened. Both the Trump and Biden administration have always stated that basic humanitarian supplies, like medicine, are exempt from U.S. sanctions list. It has also blamed the Cuban government for any shortages on food and medicine. Humanitarian organizations are not exempt from this either. Take the case of food shortages and the World Food Program. The WFP wanted to provide nutrition